Wall Street racked up another day of records, but this time it was just the Dow and the NASDAQ. The S&P 500 was left out of the party in a day characterized by very small moves either way.
Shares of Peloton dropped Tuesday, despite the company reporting quarterly results that topped Wall Street expectations. In Peloton's first earnings report since going public, revenues grew to $228 million. Beating out analysts' estimates.
Shares in jeweler Pandora tumbled on Tuesday, down around 15% by lunchtime. That after the firm said turnaround efforts weren't panning out. Pandora says it now sees sales dropping as much as 9% this year. Third quarter earnings were down by 25%. It blamed subdued consumer demand and the unrest in Hong Kong, a gateway to Chinese shoppers. The Danish firm's sales rose more than tenfold in the decade to 2017. It found a lucrative gap between cheap accessories and posher brands like Tiffany. Analysts say Pandora overstretched itself, trying to attract too broad a range of shoppers.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Wednesday. It's November the 6th, and it's 5:09 in the morning. Thank you for tuning in for another edition of The Opening Bell. Another business day getting underway here. We've put together a really good program for you this morning. We'll focus in on the business of health first up this morning with some news about cancer and how non-white cancer survivors are less likely to get the type of doctors they need and perhaps even the type of treatment they need. Dr. Nina Sanford is with us today from the University of Texas Southwestern. That'll be first up this morning. We'll go into detail about this new study and the impacts of it on our community. A little bit later in the program, D.L. Buss will be here, contributor at Forbes, Wall Street Journal, Chief Executive Magazine. You all know the UAW settled new contracts, but there is a bitter taste in their mouth with this scandal that's embroiled the United Auto Workers president and a top aide. And we'll talk to D.L. about the very latest in this coming up at about 5:38 this morning. We'll also keep you posted on the latest news, weather, sports, and traffic as we move through the hour right here on 720 WGN. But first, let's hit the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk. Futures are pointing toward a flat open on Wall Street a little bit later this morning. We've actually been watching as futures pop between negative and positive this morning. Dow futures are just up 3 points this morning. The S&P is negative by a fraction, and the NASDAQ is up just a fraction. The trading day well underway in Europe with mixed results there. In London, down by nearly a quarter of a percent. In Germany and France, up fractionally. And the trading day coming to an end in Asia. In Japan, the Nikkei up 51 points, nearly a quarter of a percent. In Hong Kong, up just a fraction. In China, up nearly a half a percent. And oil is trading this morning at 57.10 in the United States. A couple of stories as we begin this morning. You heard in the opening montage, the opening newscast as well this morning from Cranes, the story about Walgreens talking about going private and no longer being a public company. We'll keep a watch on Walgreens stock this morning in after-hours trading. There's another story involving AT&T. The company's agreed to pay $60 million to settle claims it misled customers by promising unlimited data. The Federal Trade Commission claimed the company began slowing down the data usage of millions of its customers once they reached as little as 2 gigabytes a month. In some cases, it became impossible to use smartphone apps because of the slow data speeds. The fines will go into a fund to be given as refunds to current and former customers who signed up for unlimited plans before 2011 and had their usage restricted. Facebook is revealing that as many as 100 software developers may have improperly accessed user data, including names and profile pictures of people on the platform. According to Facebook, some apps may have retained the information despite changes in Facebook's service agreement in 2018 to prevent such access. The company said in a blog post it has removed the permissions and has seen no evidence of abuse. Let's begin this morning. Business of health. A new study says non-white cancer survivors are less likely to get the types of doctors that they need, and it is likely impacting their care. Dr. Nina Sanford is with us this morning, an assistant professor at the Dedman Family Scholar. She's a Dedman Family Scholar in family care at the University of Texas Southwestern. Dr. Sanford, good morning. Welcome to the opening bell on WGN.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
I want to begin with the study headline. The study shows that, and again, we're focusing on prostate cancer, I think, is what the study focused in on.
It's all cancer
all
patients
cancer.
And survivors.
So talk to us about the headline finding of the study.
Sure. So this was a survey study called the National Health Interview Survey, which is of all patients. But we specifically looked at cancer patients and survivors. And basically, in 2017, the survey included, the survey included a supplement on cultural competency that asked patients questions such as how much they valued seeing providers culturally competent and how frequently they were able to have access to such providers. And so our major finding, which was highlighted in the research article, was that cancer patients and survivors who are not white were more likely to report valuing having culturally competent providers, but less likely to report having seen such providers in the past year.
So talk to us about what the study believes is going on here. Is it socioeconomic? Is there a health care or health insurance issue here?
So it wasn't necessarily access to care, so it wasn't that they were seeing doctors less. All these patients have seen doctors in the last month. It was more about the type of doctors that they were seeing and whether they felt those doctors had cultural competence, which is, there are many definitions for that, but one is the ability of a physician or provider to care for patients who have diverse values, beliefs, and behaviors. So we hypothesized several reasons for this potential difference. One could be not sufficient diversity of the oncology workforce. So one finding that wasn't reported in our study, but that we mentioned, was that currently only about 5% of all oncology providers nationwide are either African-American or Latino. So when the workforce is lacking in diversity, that could be contributing to difficulty in providing culturally competent care of patients of those backgrounds.
That's significant. I just wanted to jump in there because, again, you have patients who may not feel comfortable going to somebody who doesn't look like them.
Exactly. And then in addition to that, we didn't want to say that, only providers of certain backgrounds could provide culturally competent care. So another hypothesis was that irregardless of the background of the provider, they could be having trouble connecting with patients and understanding their goals of care and values. So it could be, either of those two possibilities.
I wanted to focus in and I mentioned it at the beginning, prostate cancer, because I was reading on some of the different stories about this. And some of the research, and it focused in a little bit on prostate cancer and this notion of surveillance care. Talk to us a little bit about why that's important, because there are a couple of things that happen. If you're able to monitor a patient on a regular basis and do some regular tests, you might be able to lessen the impact of the cancer. Is that a fair way to describe that?
Sure. So within different types of cancer, there have been ongoing research on disparities in care and how different patients choose different treatment or management strategies. So I think you're mentioning for prostate cancer, for certain types of cancer, especially lower risk cancers, one option is to forego treatment, upfront treatment at that time, and have what we call active surveillance, which consists of labs and exams and biopsies. And there has been research showing disparities between white patients and non-white patients in what types of treatment they choose, which could be impacting their cancer outcomes, but also obviously side effects if black patients are more or less likely to choose surveillance, which doesn't have immediate side effects versus upfront treatment.
New study, non-white cancer survivors are less likely to get the type of doctors they need. This research, Dr. Sanford, I want to get back to it. There's a couple of double whammies here, I think, for lack of a better way to describe them. It's hard to have some information on black patients because they're not in some clinical trials. Talk to us about the impact of that on what we're talking about this morning.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So That wasn't a direct focus of this study, but there has been recent research showing that representation in clinical trials is also lacking in diversity. So, you know, while the patients we see in our clinic represent our diverse patient population nationwide, studies have shown that those that enroll in clinical trials represent a much more select population, particularly many more white patients. So then extrapolating those findings to the actual clinic outside of the clinical trial setting may be difficult if the patients that are on the trials aren't the ones that you're, you know, seeing in clinic and caring for later on.
And then the other whammy is that some cancers, prostate cancer, we'll use as the example, may be more aggressive in black patients as well, which makes this even a more significant story.
Absolutely, yes. So there are studies showing that apart from disparities in care, the actual biology of prostate cancer does appear to be more aggressive among patients who are black. So exactly, that's a double whammy. If their biology is different and they're not being represented in clinical trials, then it makes it even harder to provide evidence-based guidelines to guide their care.
So as we have this conversation this morning and people are listening and thinking, okay, well, this describes my situation, what can be done not only from a patient point of view today for them to maybe take more control of their care? And then what is the bigger solution to getting more doctors, black doctors, Hispanic doctors, and the kinds of care that people need to sort of turn the tide here?
Yeah, so that's obviously a loaded question and certainly multifactorial. So cancer organizations have recognized that lack of diversity among our oncology workforce has been an issue, and our article is one of the more recent ones highlighting that potential issue. So I think, you know, getting kids interested from an early age in medicine and science, probably starting them young, will be important. Having role models in the field who are of minority background will be important. And then, during medical school, exposing minority students to these fields in oncology, and again, showing them role models who are successful and who are enjoying their careers will be important as well. And then in addition to increasing the diversity of the current workforce, training in cultural competency could be also a way to improve care for diverse patients. So teaching current providers, you know, how to provide culturally sensitive care, different backgrounds, what questions to ask, what are different cultural norms of different populations, I think could be a potential solution as well.
Yeah, and I know that it's easier said than done, but patients, specifically for the patient standpoint, being your own advocate, taking control of your care and getting in there and making sure that you're seen by the appropriate people, again, that's harder said than done, but it's something that we need to focus on.
Absolutely.
Well, Dr. Sanford, we appreciate you being with us this morning and sharing some of this research. We appreciate your time this morning. Thank you.
Yep, my pleasure.
Dr. Nina Sanford, Dedman Family Scholar in Family Care and Assistant Professor at the University of Texas at Southwestern. We'll link out to the latest research on this in the podcast of The Opening Bell coming up a little later this morning right here on 720 WGN.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning again, everyone. Welcome back to the program. It is Wednesday here in The Opening Bell. The acting president of the United Auto Workers Union says the current scandal feels like a personal betrayal. Rory Gamble says his main goal at the helm of the union is to get things cleaned up and turned over to a successor. As a clean and uncorrupted UAW, Jones and several other top leaders are under investigation for embezzlement through the last years. Jones has not been charged as of yet. Gamble says he had a condition when he took over that the UAW board let him make difficult changes to accounting and financial control. Joining us this morning to talk a little bit about this is Dale Buss. He's a contributor at Forbes, chief executive magazine in the Wall Street Journal. Dale, good morning. Welcome to WGN.
Good morning. Thanks, Steve.
I'm referring there to Gary Jones, the United Auto Workers president, who's now on leave. This all has put a real bitter taste in the mouths of some members of the UAW, even though they've just settled a contract.
Yeah, I mean, it's very sad. This is a I covered the UAW and labor relations for the Wall Street Journal back in the day, so I got to know some of the leaders of the union who were, you know, legendary figures, among them Doug Frazier, who was the president in the 80s. And this turn of events with Gary Jones has got to be making him roll over in his grave, because for all the things that critics would say about the UAW, about, for example, how over the years their demands for high compensation for their members, you know, help make the big three automakers uncompetitive and, you know, ultimately help lead to the bankruptcies at GM and Chrysler. You can make that criticism, but one thing you can never say about the UAW is that it was corrupt. And Gary Jones allegedly, and many other, you know, several other top leaders of the union have just busted that legacy all to pieces. And so when you look at the details, much of which have been reported by the Detroit News, of what the federal investigators are looking at, is just, it's really gross abuse of power. I mean, there was a raid on Gary Jones's house in August while these negotiations were going on with GM, where apparently he had $32,000 in cash stashed there. And, you know, FBI guys were counting the money outside his house after they went in to get it. And he's potentially accused of being a part of a $1.5 million embezzlement scheme. And that's all on top of spending UAW members' due money, some of the officials did, on, you know, high living out in California when they were out there for a convention, going to expensive golf courses, buying really pricey booze. It's just all kind of a mess. So it really throws this GM strike and what might have been accomplished through it into a whole different light, both in general and for UAW members who are paying a couple of hours a month in dues to the union.
Yeah, and part of the allegations here, and again, Jones has not been charged yet, but that's likely coming, is the embezzlement of nearly $700,000 in member dues. The feds have made a case against his top aide, and so what are we waiting for in terms of potential charges against Jones?
Well, given the scenario that I just described, I mean, he seems to have been, you know, sometimes top leaders in any kind of organization, whether it's political or business or whatever, will try to insulate themselves, plausible deniability, that kind of thing. But it doesn't look like that's something that Jones allegedly has done in this case. It looks like, according to the reporting so far anyway, that he's just knee-deep in this whole thing. So, you know, very significant charges, prison time, all that stuff looks to be in the cards. And again, this is a union where you could argue, wow, Jones just led this epic strike against General Motors in 6 weeks, and it cost the company $3 billion, and look at all the stuff the union got. Well, there are three problems with that. One is, now UAW leadership, or UAW rank-and-file members, know that their leadership is apparently corrupt. That's not good for the future. Number two, the UAW members know that even after 6 weeks off the job, they just didn't get much more than what GM initially offered toward the end of negotiations. The CEO of GM, Mary Barra, was very clever in kind of laying out, okay, here's what we're going to give you. 6 weeks later, after a lot of disruption in their lives and everything else, they didn't get a whole lot more than what GM was offering in mid-September. And the third thing is, after all of this, GM was able to maintain its key objective in these talks, which is to maintain labor flexibility. They're still closing the three plants that Mary Barra decided to close. And in the future, they still have flexibility to perhaps close other plants as labor demands decline in this new era of the electric vehicle. So this is a high watermark in a lot of ways for the UAW for the foreseeable future, and there's a big mess ahead as this investigation continues.
How does the union clean it up? Does this come from the bottom up, or can it be fixed? How long will it take to be fixed?
This is going to be a stain and a problem for the UAW for years to come, because given that there were a number of key figures involved, I mean, they are also investigating the previous president of the union, Dennis Williams. UAW members are right to wonder, well, how deep does this go? You know, how much can we trust, you know, anybody who comes from the current regime? So I'm not sure how you clean that up. There's a long and orderly system of people rising through the union, through regional leadership, after proving themselves at the local level. I suspect it could be the kind of thing where a reform candidate kind of arises from some local union around the country, somewhere in the country, and says, you know, I'm the only person who can clean this up. So there may be, you know, a lot of other changes in top leadership still to come. And the other thing that's looming over the UAW in this is that now, over the last several years, Michigan and Indiana, other key UAW states have become right-to-work states. So that means that potentially if the UAW can't prove to members that it's clean, that it's not corrupt, and that it can really deliver benefits to them, they're just going to walk away. I mean, there could be significant attrition in UAW membership in the months and years to come, because now legally, you know, people can walk away. They can say, I don't need the UAW, and I don't want to be a member. I'm not proud of it anymore.
Yeah, that's a possibility, but what do you think the likelihood of that really is? I mean, these members know that the UAW does do something for them that they wouldn't be able to do on their own.
Right, but here's the thing. The thing about not being a UAW member has always been, well, you can't, you know, it's solidarity. That's the UAW motto. I mean, right, look what the union has done for you. But somebody can turn around and say maybe they're not especially fond of the idea of a union anyway, and they can say, why do I want to be a member of this kind of organization? What is it doing for me? Look at its reputation. Yeah, I'm getting some benefits, but there is going to be some leakage because of this, no doubt.
Yeah, let's talk about Ford settled this their contract pretty quickly with UAW. I guess they saw what happened at General Motors and did that pretty quickly. Was that contract any better, or was it the same template as the GM contract?
It was the same template. I mean, there are a few tweaks here and there, but at Ford, the UAW and the company had been working on their contract all the while the GM strike was going on. So they were ready for this. And, you know, the decision made by the brain trust at Ford was, okay, we think we can live with basically the same template that GM got. And meanwhile, you know, we save several billion dollars in profits that GM had to give up by not taking a strike. So, I mean, this is a pretty typical development in labor talks. The second and third companies, you know, typically have a much easier time because they've had a while to look at the deal that the first company got. So that's what's happened at Ford. And right now, negotiations are going on at with Fiat Chrysler. And the situation is a little different there because Fiat Chrysler has more temporary and lower paid workers than GM and Ford do. And so the labor cost hit on Fiat Chrysler might be a little bit worse relatively than at GM and Ford, but it's still expected that they'll reach a deal without too much of a problem.
Back to the question of federal charges being filed against Gary Jones, there's some speculation that they're waiting for all these contracts to be done before they actually do that.
Yeah, that could be. I mean, clearly there are some more shoes to drop, if you will. And, you know, unfortunately for the union and for the industry, this investigation is something that's been going on for a couple of years now, at least, and started with a training fund at Fiat Chrysler. And some people have already been indicted, going to jail. You know, it's going to get worse looking before it gets better. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Dale, we appreciate you being on with us this morning. Thank you very much.
You bet. Thanks,
Steve.
Take
care. Dale Buss, a contributor at Forbes, Wall Street Journal, Chief Executive Magazine, joining us from Michigan this morning.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market, yes, futures are pointing toward a flat open on Wall Street a little bit later this morning. And Dow, NASDAQ, S&P futures all up fractionally each. Trading day in Europe is mixed. Markets in London, the lower of all of the markets. And in Asia, the trading day ending mixed as well. Markets in China lower, everything else is higher. Now, agriculture and commodities. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. Looking at market activity in agriculture yesterday, kind of a mixed day. Corn futures down a penny, soybean futures down 3.75, and spring wheat futures end of the day up 5.75 cents a bushel. Meanwhile, livestock futures at the Mercantile Exchange, lean hog futures, pretty good gain yesterday, up $2.57 a hundredweight, while live cattle futures dropped 72 cents and feeder cattle futures dropped 42 cents a hundredweight. It's another traveling day for Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue, but he won't be alone. There'll be a lot of people going with him as he begins a three-day trip to Mexico, leading a trade mission that will include members of the staff of USDA, especially Ted McKinney. There'll be more than 100 industry and government representatives, and he'll be talking to a very good customer of American agricultural products, Mexico. He'll also have people with him as directors of agriculture. We'll join him from Connecticut, from Idaho, from Maryland, from Missouri, from North Dakota, and from the state of Washington, and other trade officials with departments from Georgia, California, Minnesota, Nebraska, Nevada, Oregon, Wisconsin, and Virginia departments of agriculture will be with him on that trip. We don't have time to talk about it this morning, but in a later report today, we will talk about the Illinois Specialty Crop Conference scheduled for January 8 through 10 in Springfield. We'll talk more about that for those of you who want to make plans early. Have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You as well. A couple of more stories from the Business Ticker this morning. The Federal Communications Commission has approved the merger between Sprint and T-Mobile with conditions. Regulators released their ruling yesterday. One of the conditions for the merger to go forward is the divestiture of Boost Mobile by Sprint. The regulators say the merger should help speed up the deployment of a new 5G network, and the effort effect on competition would be mixed. Bank of America is raising its minimum wage to $20 an hour. The nation's second largest bank says the pay hike will take effect early next year and lift the pay of tens of thousands of employees. Bank of America employed nearly 170,000 people in the U.S. last year. Some new information on the number of bicycle fatalities in the United States. A government agency recommending that all 50 states enact laws requiring bicyclists to wear helmets to stem the increase in bicycle deaths. The recommendation, among several issued by the National Transportation Safety Board during a hearing on bicycle safety yesterday, the agency says 857 bicyclists died and crashed with motor vehicles in the U.S. last year, a 6.3% increase over 2017. Bicycle deaths rose even though total road deaths fell by 2.4%. Now, the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for this Wednesday. It's November the 6th. On the calendar today, leading off economic reports and information, data points of MBA, the Mortgage Bankers Association, out with mortgage applications today. Also, the EIA Petroleum Status Report is due. We'll also get the report on productivity and costs coming. Number of Fed speakers out on monetary policy and interest rates today, including Chicago Fed President Charles Evans. Patrick Harker has a speech scheduled today. John Williams also scheduled to speak on monetary policy today. The earnings calendar is full as well. A number of companies reporting quarterly earnings either before or after the bell today on Wall Street. SoftBank, Adidas, BMW, CVS Health, New York Times, Papa John's, Wendy's, Fitbit, Qualcomm, Roku, Square, TripAdvisor, Wynn Resorts. Just some of the companies expected to report quarterly earnings today. Another busy day of earnings tomorrow as well as we continue with earnings season. Among the big ones tomorrow, Disney, AMC Entertainment, Keurig, Dr. Pepper, SeaWorld, and GoPro coming tomorrow. On Friday, University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment is due. Just some of the things that could move the markets on this Wednesday, November the 6th.